Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Nate and Ed Legg continue their discussion of Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year, with a look at the indie and punk scenes headed up by REM and Black Flag. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. Or should I say, 80s roll. That's right, I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, welcoming back the Freebird Yeller himself, Ed Legg, to continue our discussion of Can't Slow Down, how 1984 became pop's blockbuster year by Michelangelo Matos. And this week we're focused on not a place, but a magazine, Matter Number 9, published out of Chicago, Illinois, July-August 1984 issue. I guess fanzine is more apropos. Pretty elegant way to sum up or to center a chapter on the what we would now call the indie underground. I guess back in the day, well, it was a mix of hardcore and what we called college rock, hardcore punk and college rock. Ed, Athens, Georgia, your hometown, big episode for you.
It is, and it's brought up a lot of things. It's kind of the walk of shame. I'm kind of kidding, but I could not have been closer, but also farther away from what was happening.
Well, that's so often the case, but you know, I think the only thing that matters is being close to what's happening in your heart. So you know, it's the friends we make along the way. It's not the cool shows we can brag about going to later, or the bands we can brag about getting into before everybody else did. But I did, of course. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, so this fanzine, Matter, was co-published. It was started by Elizabeth Phillips as an REM fanzine. And then she hires a young college freshman from Missoula, Montana. I think they were going to Northwestern in Chicago, named Steve Albini, who was like the last person I could think of. And then an REM fanzine. And sure enough, by their second album, he had savagely turned on them. Steve Albini, of course, is the auteur behind Big Black and Shellac. And also the less celebrated Rape Man, which tells you a little bit about his unfortunate habit of saying stupid, awful things and even naming bands after that. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. I've never actually gotten my hands on an issue of Matter, but I've seen reproductions of them online, including this issue, and they had advertising in the whole bit. I mean, it was pretty pro for you know, this wasn't some Xerox copy fanzine. They had ads, including ad for Reckoning, REM's second album, which touted Murmur, their first album's big wins in the Rolling Stones 1983 critics polls. So were you aware of REM and Murmur after all the critical attention they were getting?
Well, you know, in a almost kind of cool way, because I had to make a choice, and it really happened in almost in lockstep with REM's emergence, to the point that I had kind of glimpsed some of the scene and knew kind of about some things that were going on, but I was nearing the end of my sophomore year at the University of Georgia and was about to become sports editor at a four day a week newspaper that was trying to do what the University of Texas and the University of Florida student newspapers had done, which was go independent of the university, which we did. And I was having to learn how to do that job when all of a sudden all my cool friends in the features department who I'd been going to concerts with all year, going to shows with, including in Atlanta, start telling me about this band REM. And I didn't get to see them until the Friday before exams, because that's how busy I was finding out that being a sports writer means you never have a night off again, you know, or a weekend off. And even though I'd been doing it, I was the editor, so I was having to do all that stuff. So yes, I knew about it, but it was, you know, what we're about to talk about was a development I knew nothing about. So it was really fascinating when I heard Radio for Europe on the radio and did not recognize them.
Wow. So that was the first time you'd heard REM?
On the radio. No, I saw them twice in the summer that they formed. And it's right before exams. And then that summer I saw them. But that's how much they changed between the summer of 1980 and spring of 83 was when I heard Radio for Europe. And then, and what's interesting is I heard a very early version of Don't Go Back to Rockville, which appears on that second album. And I know the girl, she was a girl when it was written, and I knew her. I worked at the paper with her. That song was written about.
Wow, so, this is the girl. REM bassist Mike Mills was begging not to go back to Rockville outside D.C., Rockville, Maryland.
That is right. And she had been dating a buddy of mine. She worked at the newspaper. She'd been dating a buddy of mine. And this thing emerges. She ends up kind of vanishing from the newspaper office, and only to find out she's dating Mike. And I couldn't blame her one bit. I would have done the same thing. I mean, it was killing me. And I still had a band that was about to flame out one more time just to make sure that summer. But really, my career was about to at least go on serious hold for 5 years while I learned to be an adult, quote unquote.
I see. And I feel your pain on the sports writing thing. I've been a slave to Saturday nights for since 2007. So yeah, turning your hobby into a job is it comes at some cost, but
it does.
Yeah. So Matos, it's one thing that I thought was interesting, though, is that Matos mentions in here that at one point, I think it was Bill Berry, the drummer for REM, was shocked to discover there were 35 bands in Athens. And did you notice that none of them are mentioned in this chapter?
Yes.
And
it's fascinating.
Yeah, I thought that, and it's a reasonable choice for Matos to make, I think, because none of those bands outside REM are that well remembered now. Although at the time, when you heard about Murmur, you'd also hear about the guy who produced Murmur, which, and now I'm blanking on his name, the lead guy from Let's Active, which
is it Mitch Easter? Is that?
Yeah, Mitch Easter. Yes, Mitch Easter. Yeah. Thank you for remembering that. I should have written that down. Yeah. But yeah, Mitch Easter from Let's Active produced Murmur. He might have produced Reckoning too, but there was Let's Active, Guadalcanal Diary, Love Tractor.
Yes.
B-52s and Pylon had already, I think, moved on. Pylon had already broken up by that point. The B-52s had gone on to national stardom. They don't get mentioned in this chapter either, which is kind of interesting. But
very true.
So there was this whole scene in Athens at the time, but they were all kind of to varying degrees in the shadow of REM, both stylistically and definitely commercially. But the thing that he establishes really early on is that REM were road warriors, that these guys toured and toured and toured, and that they were one of the bands that pioneered the indie rock club network that's going to go on to build careers all the way up until, you know, Nirvana, the whole Sub Pop wave of bands that conquered the world in the early 90s. They all came up on the same circuit. And REM is one of the bands that blazed the path. And it's interesting because nowadays REM is seen as, you know, obviously they became massively commercially successful in the late 80s. And their early stuff, I would think, from the vantage point of today, would be classified as indie rather than punk. And you know, so many bands, those traditions have kind of bifurcated and bifurcated around this time. But back in the day, REM was playing the same clubs as Black Flag and DOA, the hardcore circuit, essentially. They weren't necessarily playing all the same squats and stuff that bands like MDC and Corrosion of Conformity and DRI were playing. But they were playing when it was clubs, and Black Flag was playing a lot of clubs they played in. But let's hear a little bit of REM. This is Little America by REM. And that was Little America by REM with the classic line, Jefferson, I think we're lost. I used to think that meant Thomas Jefferson and was some kind of political illusion. But it turns out it's a reference, as Matos tells us, to Jefferson Holt, who was REM's road manager. And so it was simply autobiographical. I think we're lost. Let's see, I mentioned a little bit about Albini, the editor of the fanzine that's talking about REM, but I didn't mention that Matos does a pretty elegant summary of the Chicago scene, which to some extent got overshadowed by scenes in other cities, but there really was a thriving scene in Chicago. You had Big Black, led by Steve Albini, of course, which was one of the few bands in, punk is the wrong word. I guess noise rock is probably the best term that has come to describe the wave of bands that Big Black headed up. But they used drum machines, one of the few bands in this to use drum machines and kind of have industrial elements to their sound, which really, when I was going back and listening to them for this episode, they really jump out as kind of ahead of their time compared to most of their peers that are discussed in this chapter. But they also talk about Naked Ray Gun, which was a big initially, I don't know if you'd call them hardcore, but definitely punk, a band out of Chicago. And they put out their album Throb Throb on Homestead Records in 84. And that was one of these records. I think somebody described it as adventurous music for people who didn't wear mohawks. And that was kind of what was going on in 84. In 82, 83, you had bands like the Bad Brains and Black Flag and Minor Threat emerge pushing hardcore punk and which was just a faster, more stripped down, angrier version of the kind of punk that pioneered in 77 by the Ramones and the Sex Pistols and the Buzzcocks and others. But by 84, the wave of energy that exploded in hardcore, which was not popular at the time, it was very much underground stuff. I mean, clubs wanted nothing to do with it. Radio definitely wanted nothing to do with it. Record labels wanted nothing to do with it, but it got a lot of attention with kids and tape traders. And a ton of these bands started out in this scene, but by the time we get to 1984, bands like Naked Ray Gun, which was on Homestead, and so is Big Black, they're going in different directions. And then SST Records, which is Black Flag's record label, or Greg Ginn's record label out of LA or Orange County, suddenly there's this big explosion. And this is where I jump in, because Husker Du's Zen Arcade comes out, Minutemen's Double Nickels on the Dime comes out, Meat Puppets 2 comes out. And those are records I could sink my teeth into because I was reading about them in Rolling Stone. You didn't have to buy Maximum Rock and Roll, which I couldn't even get in my hometown. Eventually, we did start mail ordering that, but you could read about the stuff in Rolling Stone, and you could buy it down at Hastings. And I remember going and buying Zen Arcade by Husker Du and feeling so tough and so hardcore. And it's pained me recently. There's this guy, the Punk Rock NBA on YouTube, Finn McKenty, that I enjoy listening to, but he picks out Husker Du as his example of like the indie rock bait and switch, where he would read critics talking about, their buzzsaw guitars and incredible over the top noise. And then he goes out and buys it. And it sounds to him like, the Beatles or something. It's like super poppy 60s rock. And he's just totally, this is somebody who's a death metal fan and a hardcore punk fan. And So I can kind of see that disconnect. But for me in 1984, when I bought Zen Arcade, I just thought I was the coolest kid. Well, I knew I wasn't the coolest kid in my hometown, but like the second or third coolest kid in my hometown. Did you come aware across the SST stuff at all at that time?
No. And I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, listen to you and thinking about my probably the person who I was, most in contact with from Athens, moved to New York around this time, and he stayed pretty dialed in. I mean, when I was a senior in college and about to, be done and get a job, he had another year to go, and he was wearing, Dead Kennedys buttons and into class, and we had a couple parties at his apartment, and he was playing, Too Drunk to Fuck, and all that stuff, which I was getting a huge kick out of, but I didn't see him for about 3 years, and he was really kind of, I believe him. I mean, he was friends with Pete Buck, Variem, before they even formed the band, so he had kind of been buddies with him, and he just was really dialed in. Then he moved to New York, so I think he really would, continue to keep a toe in that. Even he was working in trade journalism but it wasn't rock and roll. He was doing some rock and roll freelancing, but really he was more like a scenester. So I really missed 84 was really it for me, where I was really missing everything.
Well, but you can always go back and enjoy the music today.
That is true. Yes.
Yeah. And you were a little older. For me, I was 15. So this was like the definitive. This was the first time I had my own records that my big brothers didn't hand to me. Like REM was something. My big brother had moved back. He'd graduated college right into the teeth of the 80s oil bust. So he's got his geology degree, which he was sure the whole time he was going through college was going to be, this lucrative ticket to success. And graduates, and suddenly there's an oil bust and a recession, and he can't get any jobs. So he's stuck in Borger for an extra year and a half working in the highway department. So I got introduced to REM, all the two-tone stuff like the English Beat and the Specials. He had the Minutemen he was into for whatever reason. So I had Buzzer Howell under the influence of Heat, but he did not cross the line into punk. Which Minutemen, I guess, was as punk as he got. But the Minutemen are definitely punk-inspired, punk ethos, but musically much more like fast art rock and incredibly melodically creative and innovative. But that he could take. But Black Flag, Husker Du, any of that stuff, even the Replacements, was not something he got into. So for me, this was my music. This was the stuff that really excited me. And my best friend, Greg, was just a total maven. So he had the Naked Raygun album, he had the Big Black records, and Black Flag was a huge one. And they talk about Matos spends quite a bit of time on Black Flag, which I think is appropriate. But before we get to Black Flag, I want to talk a little bit more about REM being road warriors. And Matos, being from Minneapolis, uses REM's Minneapolis dates to show their organic grassroots growth, and that their first gig there, they were playing Sam's, and we talked about this in the Prince chapter. Actually, Steph tells me I need to cue before we can finish this anecdote. So let's hear another Minneapolis band. This is Husker Du's Something I Learned Today, the opener from Zen Arcade. Was Something I Learned Today, the opening song on Husker Du's Zen Arcade, which is a concept album. At least the first two sides of it are a concept album, loosely about a kid, a runaway kid, from a broken home, running away, making it to the sea, happy ending or not. And then the second record doesn't have a conceptual theme. But anyway, back to REM and Minneapolis, which is where Husker Du was from. REM was from Athens, Georgia, so they're touring all the time, very aggressive. And November 81, they play what's soon to become First Avenue, but it's still called Sam's, which we discussed that whole thing in the Prince episode last week. They play on Thanksgiving, which is a terrible night to be playing so far from home. But they got promoted to the big room instead of what they called the entry, which was the little room where punk and new wave bands would usually play. They got put in the big room, which is where Prince is going to be playing. I'm not even sure if Prince had played there yet. 88 people in November of 81. That's all that showed up. April of 82, just 6 months later, 347 people. By September of 82, 942 people are coming out. And by that time, their EP, Chronic Town, was out, and they were building momentum. They became the flagship of the American underground band. And it's interesting, you know, we talked about the second British invasion and that whole wave of bands, the Culture Club, the Thompson Twins, Eurythmics, Human League, tended to be synth pop, tended to be a lot more techie, you know, more drum machines, more synthesizers. There were some guitar arena bands in England. In fact, the Rolling Stone cover story of the British invasion had a whole big article on 10 bands that bucked the trends and had bands like The Cult and The Smiths. That were guitar oriented, the Bluebells, which is a favorite of mine that doesn't often get heard about. But for the most part, the British bands were real synth heavy, and the American bands, there was really no analog to the underground synth pop thing in America. Americans were sticking to their guitars and proved that there was still a lot of creativity to be had out of there. And then one last thing I want to mention before we switch off of REM, and this was Michael Stipe's sexuality. And Matos points out how the British invasion, second British invasion bands, like, you know, headed up by Boy George from Culture Club, were clearly playing with gender, but they still had to kind of wink and nod. And we talked about how, you know, Boy George made a major gaffe by calling himself a drag queen on the Grammys, which naive America had somehow missed. That he was doing a drag act. But anyway, but even in the underground, somebody like Michael Stipe had to essentially follow what Matos calls a don't ask, don't tell policy, where he just didn't talk openly about being gay. And Bob Mould and Grant Hart from Husker Du were in a similar boat. And it's just, it just seems like such a conservative time. And this is right when the AIDS epidemic is emerging, and so that complicated things even more. So, you know, massive Reagan era backlash happening after the Free Love 60s and 70s. But a couple other interesting points about REM. They signed to IRS, which was not a major label, although it had major distribution, and that's the label that was owned by Stuart Copeland's brother Miles, of the Police. And that meant they got to open up for the Police in August of 83. They played 5 dates to 110,000 fans. And as little indie bands that do these things, they swore it was a terrible experience, you know, and they'd never do it again. Of course, within 5 years, they're going to be headlining shows almost that big. And in 7-8 years, they'll definitely be headlining shows that big. But they were basically doing all the things that a band that wants to advance itself should do. They did the show Solid Gold Hits, lip syncing, but then they made a big deal about how they wouldn't lip sync for the video for South Central Rain and got cool points for that. That was a really interesting period of time when you could get positive press for resisting doing videos, which I think is kind of a wrong-headed approach. But anyway, do you remember any of that, the controversy about Michael Stipe and whether, it wasn't even a controversy, it was PR about how cool he was that he wouldn't lip sync.
He was okay. There's some stuff that I found out later, but there's also stuff I knew at the time that, you know, they were already involved with Ian Copeland, which is Miles Copeland's brother, and also Stuart Copeland's brother of the Police. They already were involved with him somehow by the summer of 1980.
And that's so, the touring group, FBI, right?
Yeah.
Promotions company, yeah.
Well, Bill Berry, I come to find out, I have a pretty good friend who lives in Wisconsin who is from that era. She saw their first gig, and she actually was from Macon and went to high school with at least one of Bill Berry or Mike Mills. I can't remember which. Her sister dated one of them. Her sister ended up marrying, I think his name's Curtis Crow from Pylon. So, I mean, she's really dialed in. Well, Bill Berry and Mike Mills worked for Paragon Booking, which was the Capricorn Records touring arm in the the Allman Brothers era. They were roadies at some point. This all must have been when they were in high school. So they were, and you had a show about a year ago. Somebody was doing, I think it was about this era, and he pointed out how completely connected, incredibly connected REM were, and they were. I mean, they already knew Ian Copeland. I think they knew Ian Copeland before they even formed REM. And get this, they actually opened for the Police at the Fox Theater in Atlanta in December of 1980. Just one gig. You know, they had a long way to go as they evolved. But that's how these guys, it seems like nothing happened by mistake with them. For the way I look at it now, they even had stagecraft, and Stipe was the coolest. He was easily the coolest. But they actually had stagecraft more than any other, you know, bands of, especially new bands of that era. So
yeah,
my two cents.
Yeah, they definitely earned it. And another thing I think is interesting about REM is they were one of the first bands. I think Joy Division had done this too, and maybe U2 would also do it. But you know, one of the things that's historically torn rock bands apart, Cream in particular is one that jumps to mind, is the Rolling Stones were damaged by this, or I mean Brian Jones was damaged by this. But there's such a disparity between the money that the songwriters in the band make and what the other musicians make. And REM was one of a wave of bands that solved that problem by putting all four of their names on all the songs. And since all four of them did compose, you know, they apparently it was an equitable deal and each member contributed equally. Like the Ramones did the same thing, but because Joey and Dee Dee wrote the majority of the songs, eventually they got mad at basically paying Johnny and Tommy's bills went switched back to individual credits. But REM, I believe, stuck with the collective credits at least through Automatic for the People. I lose track of them after that. But yeah, very smart move. It cuts down on the financial disparities in a band and the kind of bitterness that tore a band like Cream apart. So yeah, they did everything right. They worked really, really hard. And so
yes,
even though from my perspective now, they seem kind of retro and not particularly innovative, but because the kind of folk rock they were doing at the time was so out of fashion, I mean, it hadn't been popular since the mid 60s that, and then Michael Stipe's murmured vocal style and his abstract lyrics, it gave it this whole mystique. And so Murmur just, you know, in 83, I mean, I can remember going to record stores in Amarillo and my brother and his friends, you know, had the cool record store girl that they were desperate to talk to. And she was so busy talking about REM and Michael Stipe, she had no time for him. You know, there was this real mystique about REM amongst, you know, college kids and hipsters at that point in time. But let's keep moving and take our sponsor break. When we come back, we'll talk about Husker Du and Black Flag.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycom order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
I think I'm going to do a little swerve because I already teased talking about Black Flag, and an SST record starts with Black Flag, and hardcore punk pretty much starts with Black Flag. Black Flag on the West Coast, at least, and Bad Brains on the East Coast. It's interesting also the Bad Brains don't get talked about in this chapter, but they were on hiatus. They broke up in 83 and didn't come back together until 85, 86. So makes sense. He's got a lot of ground to cover. But Black Flag, formed in Orange County, Hermosa Beach, California in 1977, don't play their first gig until 1979, and put out first records independently, Nervous Breakdown comp in 1979, and then managed to make themselves the LAPD's most hated band before they even found an audience because, Greg Ginn's brother, Raymond Pettibone, who's gone on to great success as a fine artist, designed the legendary Black Flag bars, which is four bars vertically off kilter. So it looks kind of like a flag waving. And they painted that all over Los Angeles. And then one of their first singles was called Police Story. Pettibone drew a poster that went with that, with a picture of a cop with a gun in his mouth, and the LAPD just saw red and absolutely hated Black Flag, and the whole scene that rose around Black Flag, which encouraged Black Flag to leave town and tour, which is one of the reasons they became the bands, along with REM and DOA, who really were the Johnny Appleseeds of this underground punk network. And this is something we've talked about on Let It Roll a lot. You know, in the 60s, you could make a living as a dance band. So somebody like the MC5 were full-time musicians before they had a record deal. But very quickly thereafter, bands in the early 70s, like Cheap Trick or Kiss, you could not make a living playing original music anymore. And you'd have to get funding and audition and start with a record company. It became this whole big, very difficult process. There was an enormous gulf from being a garage band to being a new act that was going anywhere, that was signed to a major label and getting radio play and touring. And so what these indie bands are doing is recreating the possibility of being an independent band without massive record company or management support, even though it was very, very hard to make a living. I mean, Black Flag are literally living off $1 or $2 a day each through this whole period, but they toured relentlessly. They recruited Henry Rollins out of the DC hardcore scene in 1981. They put out the Damage album, which Matos cites as selling 80,000 copies, which I haven't seen in other places, but it seems believable. But they'd signed a deal with a MCA subsidiary called Unicorn to do that. Some vice president of MCA declared the Damaged album anti-parent, refused everything to do with it. So Black Flag had to, or SST Records then took over the distribution from Unicorn. They get involved in a nasty lawsuit. They're literally under injunction, can't use their name, can't play live gigs, can't record. They put out an album called Everything Went Black without their name on it and still got busted and got in trouble. But ultimately, they were aggressive enough to, and they knew that Unicorn, allegedly the Unicorn execs were up to some shady dealings, and basically Unicorn was a money laundering front. And Greg Ginn only playing offense. They did their own legal work. They hired a lawyer to sign off on what they did, but they did their own legal work and basically beat Unicorn in court. And so in 1984, they come roaring out of the gate, a whole new band. It's boiled down to just Greg Ginn and Henry Rollins. All the other members, including co-founder Chuck Dukowski, the original bass player, frequent songwriter, were all vibed out of the band. And so you got Bill Stevenson on drums and Kara Roessler on bass. And they just bust out. They bust out My War in, I think, late 83. Then the Family Man album, which was half instrumentals and half spoken word. The Slip It In album. And then the Live 84 tape. So they just flood the market with product. They're back on the road, touring everywhere. And you know, really make an impact. But the thing was, damaged codified hardcore punk, and My War moved against it, and people were really confused. It was really interesting to watch Black Flag become less and less popular the harder they worked throughout this whole period, so that by 86 they were playing much smaller clubs than they had played in 81 and or in 84. Really interesting period of time. But at the same time this is going on, Henry Rollins is becoming like this media star. Like, do you remember when he was in Spin magazine writing essays about 7-Eleven and stuff like that?
Vaguely, but yes. And he was clearly visible.
Yeah. He was a known entity, even though, you know, the scene was quite underground. They were getting no radio play, and you know, they'd grown their hair out and they were sounding very metal, and so they were antagonizing. Yeah, you know, they're part of this hardcore scene which is totally underground, and they choose to alienate their own scene, you know, which may have been the right artistic decision, but it certainly confused people. But there was a little tidbit in here I had no idea about, that Henry Rollins had gotten to be pals with Van Halen's David Lee Roth and ended up ghostwriting Roth's autobiography, Crazy from the Heat, a couple years later. That I thought was just hilarious. I'm gonna have to read that book again and then look for signs of Henry Rollins.
Yeah, because it sounds just like David Lee Roth. I mean, I've read it, and I mean, it sounds just like Diamond Dave. I mean, what the hell?
Well, I mean, he did what any good ghostwriter does. He listens to a source and he puts, you know, just got to take what Diamond. I'm sure he'd heard mountains of prose coming out of Diamond Dave.
He just
had to remember what he was saying and write it down in his voice. You know, that's the classic ghostwriter's work. But Black Flag forms this label, SST, as a consequence. I mean, they already had the SST label, but they decide to go all in and just stay independent after their disastrous attempt to work with MCA. And they start putting out all these records by other bands. The Minutemen are the first band that they sign up. And by 84, the Minutemen are building a critical reputation. And it was interesting because hardcore punks, like in my experience with the Minutemen, or what I was told later, by the time I got to go to see hardcore shows, D Boone had already died. But everybody I knew that saw him said, you know, you would go see the local opening hardcore band and then you'd go out and smoke cigarettes while the Minutemen were playing, and then you'd go back in for Black Flag or whoever the headliner was. And that's probably a little harsh, but that was kind of the doctrinaire hardcore view of the Minutemen. Whereas people like my brother who were into art rock loved them. And so, you know, when Devil Nickels on the Dime came out, yeah, that was another record that was just absolutely life-defining for me. The song, you know, and of course Michael Azarad's famous book was named This May Be Our Band, Could Be Your Life. You know, it just meant everything to us. And I can remember in my high school, D Boone died, I believe, in December of 1985, And we didn't hear about it until March, I want to say, when it was in a national magazine. And literally three or four of my friends wore black armbands to school the next day just to have completely disconnected from time. But and then the last SST band I want to talk about was the Meat Puppets that Matos talks about, which these were these acid fried freaks from Phoenix, Arizona, whose first album was way weird. It wasn't really hardcore, but it was so intense and crazy. It slipped in with hardcore, but their second album sounded like a cross between hardcore and the Grateful Dead and really blew people's minds. And I was immediately a massive fan of that. But let's go ahead and hear our next song. And this is X, I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. And that was I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts by X. And this was kind of their anthem and kind of a desperate last-ditch appeal. Like the lyrics literally say, I hear the radio is finally going to play new music. You know, the British Invasion. But what about the Minutemen, Flesh Eaters, DOA, Big Boys, and the Black Flag? Will the last American band to get played on the radio please bring the flag? There's no better way to get banned for life than the radio. They're bitching about the program director's song selection. And I think by this point, X was getting pretty desperate because they had been the leader of the LA punk scene from 77 on. They were on Slash Records, produced by Ray Manzarek. Then they signed with Elektra and just could not get radio play. They got, you know, no end of critical praise in the press, but could not get on the radio. And by this point, we're embittered about it and ended up doing a really ill-advised version cover of Wild Thing, where they got Michael Wegener, a metal producer, the guy who produced Accepts, Balls to the Wall, and would go on to produce Dokken and Skid Row, and did just a really atrocious version of Wild Thing and just a total desperation move. And it's interesting. One of those bands that I would say was kind of curdled by their lack of commercial success. Were you following X through this period?
Well, you know, I know that's the band Xene Cervenka was in, right?
Yeah.
And John Doe. Yes, yep. I knew about him. I had a friend who wrote a story about him when he was one of my newspaper buddies at the Miami Herald, so I was paying attention that way. Do you know what the reference is to cavemen and astronauts in that song? This is really freaky. There was one of those shows that didn't last very long. It's Gilligan's Island era TV show. So we're talking mid 60s TV show.
And it was about the car era type stuff.
Yes. Way to go, man. Good reference. And that's right from my, early memory bank. And when I saw those words, this song is like, it's about time. It's about space. You know what I mean? I just remember, those theme songs are really good in those days, as you probably remember, but
yeah,
that was a cool reference anyway. And I have this respect for X for some reason, like those two names just conjure a fine brand.
Yeah.
X-Zine, I mean, and John Doe.
They were never one of my favorites. I was too young for them, but I definitely respect him, and they definitely, were seen as major contenders and major going to be an important band at the time. I think some of their works held up quite well, but they missed their window. Like that, one of their complaints was that groups like, quote, Blondie, the Pretenders, Devo, and the Go-Go's had all cracked the Hot 100, and we were stuck playing dirty clubs. But as Matos points out, by 1984, Blondie had already broken up. Half of the Pretenders were dead. They'd reformed and were commercially successful. It was really never the same, other than that one follow-up album they did after James Honeyman Scott's death. Devo's Shout album stiffed, and we later historians find out that it was a record executive I believe at MCA, who deliberately smothered Devo. And even after Whip It was such a massive hit that some executive took over and just did not like Devo and suffocated him. And then the Go-Go's had broken up. And the Go-Go's are one of these bands where my impression of them at the time and what was actually going on with them were so different. It's just absolutely shocking. Like, you know, my high school band played We Got the Beat. Like, I just thought of the Go-Go's as wholesome, fun, great, you know, great new wave rock and roll. And then come to find out their main songwriter was a junkie. They had this really horrific video where they sexually abused some male groupies. I mean, they were living a much, much wilder life than I had any concept. And it all come a cropper by 84 that you know, Jane Wildland quit in a fury. After she felt like she was getting squeezed out and Belinda Carlisle was getting made the star. And I'm blanking on the name of the woman who actually wrote most of the hit songs, but she was the one with the heroin problem. And, you know, it's just, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. And it's a long way down from the top if you make it really quick. And
Was it Kathy Valentine? Was she the writer?
She's the bass player. Now, she was the bass player. She was brought in. I got to Google this.
Or Charlotte Caffey. Was Charlotte Caffey the writer? I know most of them. See, these are all bands that I still
Yeah, enjoy. It was Charlotte Caffey was the main songwriter, for sure. And they were another band that was torn apart by songwriting royalties because Gina Schock, the drummer, was really pissed
Gina when Schock.
She saw
yes.
when she
Good
saw
point.
Caffey's first royalty check.
Like Queen. Yeah. Like, that sounds like Queen.
Well, Queen, at least they all four got to write hits at various times and got the big
eventually,
checks.
But yeah, eventually. Supposedly on your show, I heard that, you know, the drummer was driving a much nicer car and had a house before everybody else. But I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating, but that's the one that I always think of where they were living different lifestyles.
Oh, I mean, it goes all the way back to the Byrds where Gene Clark's driving a Ferrari after their first album came out, and David Crosby and Jim McGuinn, later Roger McGuinn, were just like, what is going on here? But yeah, so the Go-Go's are victim to basically every rock and roll cliche there could be. And Matos mentions that Jane Wildland quit the band and went to see This Is Spinal Tap the same day and broke down in tears. So, you know, but I do want to talk about a pivot. Actually, I should play our next song, and I'll talk about a pivot, a pretty elegant pivot Matos makes to cover another big factor that was going on the scene. And this is The Replacements, I Will Dare. That was I Will Dare from The Replacements off their Let It Be album, one of the classics of college rock from the era. But and The Replacements kind of fit in. He says even The Replacements fit into this trend he's talking about. And he uses the Meat Puppets as the segue, because the Meat Puppets not only were Grateful Dead influenced, but also had a country influence. Or to me, it was more like country by way of the Grateful Dead, because, of course, the Grateful Dead had the two classic country rock albums, American Beauty and Working Man Dead. But there was this whole Americana, and it wasn't called Americana yet, but this Americanism scene that was going on. And X, you know, the song we quoted, I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts, was part of that. This pride in being an American band and sort of, you know, endless grappling with what does it mean to be American. But there was this whole wave of bands like Rank and File out of L.A., I think they ended up moving to Austin, Texas. Alejandro Escovedo definitely did out of there. But they were, you know, refugees from the Nuns. And I can't remember the other punk band, the Zeros, I want to say, that formed this country punk band called Rank and File. There was Jason and the Scorchers out of Nashville, Blood on the Saddle, Tex and the Horseheads out of L.A., also True West and the Long Riders out of L.A. You had Green on Red out of Arizona. There was just this whole sort of cowpunk movement, and there were more bands they don't even mention, like Law and Justice and several others, and this was something that got a lot of record company attention, but didn't click none of them ever clicked commercially. And for the most part, bands would kind of go through this thing. Like REM is one of the few bands that both did the whole grassroots road warrior thing and worked with first an indie label and then ultimately Warner Brothers, a major label, and you know, rode it all the way to the top. But most of these bands that were not quote unquote hardcore, like there was a real line after, you know, the punk new wave split. And to me, all these bands like Rank and File and Jason and the Scorchers, even though that a lot of them had come up originally in the punk scene, they were very much trying to not be part of the hardcore scene. Their audiences were older. They were going for the college rock audience, and they were trying to, a lot of them did, you know, get major label deals or major indie deals, but for the most part, they didn't click. And it didn't work. But it's kind of a fascinating thing. And he traces the source of it to the LA scene. And X was a big part of that. X was very punky, but also had a roots aspect. But you also had the Gun Club. Jeffrey Lee Pierce's band did an incredibly great first album. Very bluesy, haunted, weird America sound. You had the Blasters, who were straight up rockabilly, but with a kind of a punk edge or high energy. You had the Cramps, who were, you know, degenerate rockabilly, punk stuff. And, you know, that kind of evolves over time into this cowpunk scene. Were you cognizant?
Yes, I was. And I liked it. And I really got to like, and Jason and the Scorchers came through Athens when I was still in school.
I heard they were great live. I never got to see them.
It sounds like it. And I didn't see them. I mean, that was the thing. By then, there actually was
the basketball
not only
game.
A scene. Yes. Yeah, basically. And I mean, I was stringing for Associated Press by then. I mean, I was all in. You know, I'm trying to get a real job. And but there were stories about how wild they were in restaurants and things like that. And that this is tasty music. I mean, this is all that you're mentioning, all these bands that I really liked. And I was in my mid 20s and I had older friends who I'd known in school who were turning me on to a lot of this stuff. You know, even Jonathan Richman and things like that, which I know is not quite, I mean, that's a little more Berserkly Records and all that, but Lone Justice. I mean, I eventually was in a late 80s band that was really, I think, influenced by Lone Justice quite a bit, because we had a female lead singer. But this, you know, when it was all, I'd much rather listen to all this than the Eagles.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just a matter of mood, whether you want to take it easy or take it up a few notches. I remember seeing Rank and File on Austin City Limits and really being excited by them and really enjoying their Sundown album. But then their second album came out, and this was something that happened over and over again in the 80s, where a band would put out a first album with a really distinctive sound, and then they would put out a second album and it would sound like an 80s record. Like some producer had gotten hold of them and started doing those gated drums and the keyboards and the echo and all that stuff. And so it happened over and over again. And one band he doesn't mention, because they don't quite fit this narrative, was Dream Syndicate out of LA, which their first album was very Velvet Underground influenced. And then their second album comes out and it sounds like they're trying to be the Rolling Stones. And I just remember over and over again, I remember my brother coming home with the second Gun Club album, which had been produced by Christina Blondie, and the second Violent Femmes album. Violent Femmes is one I think he should have mentioned, because they could have fit into this country thing with that acoustic sound. But, you know, so often these bands, their second album, the Pogues was another one that, you know, had this distinct, rootsy first album. And then the second album, it sounds like they're trying to sound like U2 or something. And it just happened over and over again. And, you know, it was really hard. Really until Nirvana. I mean, a number of bands like REM made it big without losing their underground credibility in the late 80s. But for a lot of bands, it was very hard, including this last band we're going to talk about, which is The Replacements, which, you know, they were the other big punk band out of Minneapolis, but they were always self-consciously aiming for the top. Like Peter Jesperson, their manager, and I think he also owned Twin Tone Records. I'm not sure.
He was one of the founders. Yeah, he was.
And so they saw themselves as grooming the replacements for a major label. And Paul Westerfield had all the song writing talent in the world. They had real punk, like their first album, Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash, you know, had real punk cred. Great album. Bob Stinson was just a great noise punk guitar player. And then Let It Be in 84, I think was their fourth album, was just the perfect mix. And as Mato said, it hit college radio like a pipe bomb. And that their song, I Will Dare, the single off of that with a mandolin solo by Pete Buck of R.E.M., was number one at 55 college radio stations. And they immediately get gobbled up by Sire Records, Seymour Stein, the legendary A&R man, record label owner who recently passed away, you know, signed him up. But then, you know, Tim was produced by Tommy Ramone and it didn't sound good. And Bob Stinson was melting down. And to me, the Replacements just never matched the momentum they had. And it was kind of like, you know, the thing I think of is The Simpsons, because The Simpsons had this great run for 5 or 6 seasons, which is incredibly good. And then the critics discovered it as it was losing its quality. And to me, The Replacements had that same thing where the worse their records got, the more the nerds at the college radio station were raving about them and the more critics were singing their praises. And for me, as a Bob Stinson fan and a fan of you know, Sorry Ma and their first album and stuff, it just drove me crazy. Like this band just kept getting worse and worse and getting more and more praise and also went nowhere commercially. They are the band who took their record label video budget, pointed a camera at a speaker, and that was their video. And yeah. I mean, they got good press out of it, but they sure didn't get their video played on MTV. And I just see that as just totally willful self-sabotage. But anyway, what's your take on that?
I moved to Minneapolis in 1990, so it was the very end of it. And they really were still darlings there. In fact, this is in some ways the most critical thing of it. And I don't mean negative critical, just more not raving about them, because that's what they were getting in Minneapolis. But what you said about self-sabotage, I mean, they are the band that pulled defeat from the jaws of victory
over and over again. Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. And I got curious right before the show and I started reading the beginning of the book, Trouble Boys, about them. And I mean, the stuff about Bob Stinson is as tragic as anything I've ever read about anybody. I mean, it is just so, and I'm talking about his childhood. I'm not even talking about later, but I'm a Bob Stinson fan. I am a total fan of the original setup and what they were doing. It just is, I just think that the you know, you pour booze on everything. And the first time I really heard about them was in 86, believe it or not, and at one of these friends' wedding from Athens. And another friend's telling me about them. And the number one thing he keeps telling me was that they're always drunk. And, you know, I've heard so, and I never saw them live. I've never seen them. But I've heard so many stories about 1 minute they were playing like the Who or the Stones at their best. You'd see them one night. The next night it would be like an assault, like you're being assaulted.
Yeah. And that was their reputation, you know, and, you know, the reputation was when they're good, they're the best band on earth. And when they're bad, they're terrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had that bootleg cassette When the Shit Hits the Fans. And, which is pretty enjoyable. I never got to see them. I numerous people, you know, told me how awesome they were live or how terrible they were live.
Yeah.
You know, and they definitely became legendary. And it's interesting to me that a lot of younger people, I know people in their 30s or early 40s, really know them and respect them and admire them in a way that they don't say care for Husker Du or the Meat Puppets or some of the other bands from that period that for me personally have held up a lot better. But for whatever reason, I just got really allergic to late period REM and late period Replacements. And I think because they had been favorite bands of mine I still have a pretty big animus. And I, before we wrap though, I want to mention, he also talks about Los Lobos, which was very much at the nexus of this. Well, they were really on the Roots side of thing. I mean, they were literally a Los Angeles Chicano wedding band. Like they would brag about how if you got married in LA between 73 and 81, we probably played your wedding if you were a Chicano. And yet at 1980, they open up for Johnny Rotten's Public Image Limited at the Olympic Auditorium and totally get booed off stage and pelted, but they went with it. And pretty soon they're opening up for the Blasters at the Whiskey at Go-Go. And because they were virtuoso musicians who could do anything, this scene really worked out for them. They signed up for, they signed to Slash. And I think then they jumped and did a Time to Dance. I think they were on IRS for How We'll Survive. I really should know that. Should check that fact. But How Will the Wolf Survive was just one of those albums that got mega good press. And they actually parlayed that into a real career. Of course, they had the La Bamba cover, which went to number one a couple years later. But they it was on Slash. And by this point, Slash was part of Warner Brothers. So they were not on IRS. They were on Slash the whole time. But yeah, it just got total critical praise and established a really successful long-running career. They did not have the problem that most of these younger, more new wavy type bands had. They just did their thing. And they just became touring legends, you know, the Austin City Limits. You know, I had older cousins that were 20 years older than me that loved Los Lobos in the early 90s. You know, they just carved a great career out of it. But any final thoughts on the indie and punk scene chapter?
Well, they did. They played, I will say about Los Lobos, they played their first gig in Atlanta, I think, was at the 688, which the 688 was the first punk club. In Atlanta, that's where the second time I saw REM in 1980, Los Lobos, I think, played in 84 at the 688. And it happened to be the night before one of the original members of the Side Effects funeral was. He passed away. He was an older guy, and he was actually the ex-husband of Vanessa Briscoe of Pylon. And they formed a band. The Side Effects were reviewed by Chris Goh and the Village Voice, and they toured, and they were one of those scene like Love Tractor. They're the same era. And my buddy told me he saw Los Lobos the night before the funeral. They all went down and crashed in somebody's Atlanta pad and saw Los Lobos and then went to that funeral. So and that was a turning point in that scene. There was a couple of untimely deaths of people. I think there was a car crash that took out somebody in that early scene that was a, you know, kind of a hard thing. I think REM wrote a song about her. So anyway, there you have it. A little more inside stuff.
I see. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting that I think the punk scene was open-minded enough for bands like Los Lobos, Blasters to find an audience and to thrive. And then because they weren't punk, they didn't have any of those negative qualities that the radio programmers didn't hate them, you know. So Los Lobos got some radio play. I don't know, I'm not sure how well the Wolf survived. I mean, they really did kind of get their commercial break with the
La Bamba.
You know, a couple of years later with the Lou Diamond Phillips biopic on Ritchie Valens. But, you know, all's well that ends well. And they certainly deserve their success. Incredibly talented musicians. And so it's been a hoot, as always, discussing Michelangelo Matos's excellent book, Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. And next week we'll be back and we'll be going to the Danceteria in New York City and talking about the dance scene of 1984. So looking forward to that.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate concludes the Three Kings of Emo Rap miniseries with a look at the life and death of Juice WRLD. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.